This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan is away. If there's one thing that's been driven home by the financial mess we're in, it's that our economy is almost entirely based on credit. And those who say that a bailout is imperative are warning that if the credit market dries up, all kinds of terrible things may happen. Businesses will fail to meet their payrolls or close down altogether. Consumers will stop buying things, which means the people who make those things will lose their jobs. Students will have to put off college because they can't get a loan. What exactly does the credit crisis mean on Main Street? We'll be speaking to an expert on this subject shortly. Also with a struggling business owner, and with you. Later in this hour, Shakespeare returns to its roots with an all-male cast. But first, how is this credit crisis affecting your business? How is it affecting your family? Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Janet Hildreth. She is a partner in the business Tree Lovers Floors, based in San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Janet.
Thank you.
Now, I know you're in the hardwood flooring industry, and I know you've been having some problems with credit. Explain what's happened to your business.
Well, we are in the high-end market of the sector, so we have always felt that we could pretty much weather through any kind of downturn in the market. But lately, our phones have just stopped ringing, and I put myself into a position where if such a thing were to happen, I felt that I was secure. I've had several lines of credit, and they've been frozen or taken away for no other reason but that either the banks are going under or one bank told me, well, you haven't used it, so we took it away from you.
Well, what were the lines of credit? Explain what they had. And are these the kinds of lines of credit that pretty much anybody could get?
They are. I mean, one was simply a $30,000 line of business credit. And I've had that line of credit for over 20 years. I've used it occasionally when cash flow was low or when I had a big deposit that I had to pay. And I've always paid it back, paid it on time. The other was a $250,000 home equity line of credit from IndyMac Bank. And that was my bailout money if anything were to happen with my business, my family. And I received a letter about a month before IndyMac closed saying that they had frozen my line of credit due to a dip in my FICO score, which I couldn't find any, but apparently they seem to have, you know,
and the FICO score is
significant.
You can explain what the FICO score is.
Well, it's just your credit rating.
Right.
In my credit rating.
All right. Now, did you ever expect something like this could happen? I mean, it sounds like you thought you had it laid out pretty carefully that if anything went really bad, you had something to fall back on.
I did. I positioned myself. I'm very cautious, and I, you know, I'm a business owner, but I'm a small business owner, and it feeds my family, and I have 40 employees who have families, and that's kind of what my business does, is it affords a living for us. I am not building any empires, and so it was important for me to cover myself, and now I find that I am not only not covered, but I'm having to lay off half of my employees this week.
Oh, really? How many employees do you have?
I have 40, and we'll have to let 20 of those go. And they've been with us for a long time. They're part of our family. It's really, really hard.
So this is pretty wrenching for everybody.
It is. It's, I guess I'm not embarrassed to say I've been in tears every day this week. But, you know, really, what I have seen is that people pat me on the back and say, hey, you know, things will get better. But what my message is look, guys, you know, no one is immune to this, and there is no magic bullet. This is where our economy is right now, and we all have to start thinking about how we're going to weather it.
Yeah, I mean, when you say you're letting 20 of your employees go, I'm just wondering, what does that mean for your business carrying on with 20? Can you carry on with the 20 people? Or
we can. I mean, we have to do that because there's not enough business. I mean, we've been strong in the business community in for 36 years. Mm. We've never had to lay off an employee. We've built our business over the years. I think in 95, we only had 15 employees. So we've built our business up. We've always increased in revenue every year. You know, the economy's been good. The work has been coming. But as I said, the phones are simply not ringing. And if they are ringing, it's at the lower end people, the more affordable companies that, you know, are getting what little businesses out there.
So when you say this is the way things are and we have to face up to it, are you saying we have to face up to the fact that our economy has really changed and that you're going to have to do business differently? Or do you think, are you watching the bailout debate and thinking perhaps, you know, if that gets resolved, you'll be able to get the credit that you want? What do you mean?
Well, I just think that even getting credit doesn't really satisfy the business answer. I feel like everyone should be, educate themselves as to what's going on and to look for ways that if they do get into a situation similar to mine, that they have a way to continue feeding their families or what have you. I was speaking with a woman at the EDD, and she said that they are working from 6:30 a.m. till 6 o'clock Monday through Friday and all day on Saturday to keep up with the amount of unemployment that they're having to deal with here in California. So I'm not seeing this as an overnight fix with the bailout.
We're talking with Janet Hildreth of Tree Lovers Floors about how the credit crunch is affecting her business. And joining us now from member station WABE in Atlanta, Georgia, is Dean Faust. He is the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week. Dean, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, you've been listening to Janet's story. How typical is the problem she's facing? How widespread is this problem?
It's very typical, and it's very widespread right now. We talked to a small business owner in Baltimore the other day who had his line of credit pulled, and he went to another bank to see about getting the line of credit, which he uses to meet payroll and day-to-day bills. And the bank said, would be happy to make it to you, but only if you buy a he wanted $175,000. They said, we'll make it if you buy a $175,000 CD from us and hold it here on deposit. And he laughed because, in effect, that was a roundabout way of they didn't trust to put the money out with him unless he gave them a like amount back.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you something because, you know, there's been a question of trust with regard to this whole bailout, which now is being called also a rescue plan. And it seems to me that since the beginning of the discussion about the bailout, the argument has shifted to more emphasis on the tightening of the credit markets instead of on Wall Street, on the problems in the stock market. And I'm just thinking that people may think, well, this is just another ploy to sell this plan. So maybe is it a ploy or is it really as serious as the experts are saying, this whole tightening of the credit markets?
It is not a ploy and it is a serious. Warren Buffett himself, the famous billionaire investor, the other day called it the equivalent of an economic Pearl Harbor. And he said, I know that sounds melodramatic, but that's where we're at right now. We've reached a wise editor once told me that the business world is driven off of two emotions, fear and greed. We went through a 10 or 15 year period where it was largely driven by greed, and now we're in a state of fear. Businesses, lenders, bankers, no one trusts anyone else at this point. And the net effect is everyone is scared. If you're a bank or a lender, you're scared to make a loan for fear you might not get repaid. Things are so uncertain right now. And the Fed is, you know, they're doing everything they can. They're now talking about maybe cutting interest rates again. But there's a phrase called pushing on a string that the Fed occasionally uses. And I think that's where we're at right now. They've already cut the Fed funds rate to 2%. It's pretty close to zero. They can cut it a little bit lower, but is it going to help? I mean, just lowering the borrowing cost, does that make businesses and lenders and any feel more comfortable that they're going to get repaid? And the answer may be no.
Let me just go back a minute before we move forward with this discussion. I just keep wondering why from the beginning it wasn't put in these terms, the argument wasn't made in these terms at the beginning of the whole question of the need for a bailout. Because people, the public obviously saw it in terms of bailing out Wall Street. That's what we've been hearing, bailing out their wealthy stockbrokers. Now I think people are beginning to understand, you know, how it may be affecting small business owners like Janet, you know, how it may be affecting Main Street. But it seems to have taken an awfully long time to really get that message across.
You're correct. And I think that if Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and all of the other policymakers in Washington, if they could have a do-over, they would probably never use or never let the words bailout and rescue be used, because there is a perception which fed into the decision by so many members of the House of Representatives earlier this week to vote against it. Their phones are ringing off the hook from angry constituents saying, don't bail out the Wall Street fat cats. That's not so much what this is all about. This is also about providing the funding that the nation's, the factories use to pay their payrolls and to buy inventory and raw materials, and for small business owners to buy their inventory. So yes, you can vote against, you can deny the money for this rescue package. And then what happens when the factory you work at closes next week? Or the car that you wanted to, your car breaks down, you need a new one, and you can't get a car loan because the dealer can't get loans from its bank. So they're very wide ripple effects.
Janet, do you have faith at this point that the government can do something to help you out? I mean, are you really watching these what's going on in Capitol Hill right now closely?
Well, I'm watching it as closely as I can while still trying to keep my business afloat. I think it might be the lesser of two evils, maybe. I don't see that anything is going to miraculously change the economy, but, you know, I'm starting to think that it may be the only way to go.
You're starting to see what is happening on Wall Street and on Capitol Hill is affecting
people
like you.
Right, and how that will affect my business.
Yeah, you're starting to make the connections, and maybe other people are as well. Thanks for joining us today, Janet. Janet Hildreth is a partner with Tree Lovers Floors, that's based in San Francisco. We're going to continue this discussion after a short break. Dean Faust will stay with us. He's the Atlanta Bureau Chief of Business Week magazine. And if you'd like to join our discussion on the credit crunch, the number is 800-989-8255, or send us an email to talk@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Credit markets sound very wonky, but what we're really talking about is whether or not you can get your hands on cash. That means loans for cars or houses, or tapping that home equity line you thought you were going to use for juniors' college. It's also the money your company uses to pay your salary. We're talking with Dean Faust about what this credit crunch means on Main Street. He's Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week magazine. How is the credit crisis affecting your business? How is it affecting your family? 800-989-8255. You can share your stories on the blog as well. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we're going to take a call now from Marcia. And Marcia is calling from Clovis, California. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Well, I spoke to a gentleman earlier and mentioned that we have a business that's actually a money saver business, and we're still not getting the calls we used to. We provide insulation for pre-existing homes, and, you know, when people were fat, so to speak, in the business, they use that term, and they had home equity and they were upgrading their homes, that was the time when you put in the fancy granite and the hardwood and the home theaters. But we also did very well with in our business doing insulation for the pre-existing homes. And I'm concerned because even something as basic and as energy-saving long-term, you know, lowering your PG&E bill, doesn't seem to matter. We're still getting calls, but our business has dropped off significantly. And the other thing that I've noticed is that people are afraid in general to talk about it. I have a lot of friends who own businesses, and I'll say, how's business for you? And they're very quiet until I volunteer, well, you know, we're down quite a bit from last year, more than half. And then suddenly the story just starts spewing out. It's just people say, I don't know why I even came today to open my store.
Oh, wow.
Comes in. And these are the friends that I have that I'm talking to own stores that are bookstores or the extras that you get in life.
Right.
When I'm looking at something we produce that's necessary.
But you're also saying your business is down, you think, because people can't get their home equity line of credit.
Yeah. And I was worried when this started up because I thought now we're against the rock and the hard place where we're going to see how much of that extra money that people had, where it was really going and where it was really coming from. And you know, you could see this. The thing that gets to me is that you could see this coming quite a long time ago. And I think in my own perception, I think that the government turned a blind eye to it because they felt it might shake out by itself. Okay, people who really couldn't qualify to pay these long-term loans aren't going to be able to, shouldn't have bought homes anyway, so they'll shake out and it'll straighten out. And in fact, that hasn't happened. I think the repercussions have been unanticipated, obviously, but I'm angry because I think that the government, please tell me they can't be that foolish and unimaginative to see that this could come to this point. And now here's this panic attitude that of course, everyone's resentful of.
All right, Marcia, thanks so much for your call. Let's respond to what Marcia was saying there, Dean. Why did the government not anticipate this? She's angry. She feels like they must have been able to anticipate this.
I think it's a good question why bank regulators didn't see what was going on in the types of mortgage loans that banks were making. But that said, so much more of all the mortgage loans that were being made earlier this decade were not being made by banks. They were being made by this new system network of independent mortgage brokers who sold it to a unregulated, they could sell it directly to Wall Street, which then bundled it into these mortgage-backed securities and, you know, CDOs and CMOs and all these other acronyms we don't understand. So a lot of it was going outside of the banking system, and that may be one explanation why the regulators didn't spot it this time, because the financial system had changed around them.
You know, a recent article in Business Week said credit is the lubricant for the U.S. economic engine. I wonder if you can break that down for us in terms that everybody really understands. How is it the lubricant for the economic engine?
You can use the whatever metaphor you want. It's the lifeblood or the oil that runs the engine. Someone liken it to the oxygen. But it's simply that you need the day-to-day money to meet your payroll, for a small business to have the money to not only pay its workers every Friday, but to front the money to its suppliers while it's waiting to get paid from its own customers. You know, there's that lag between when you have to borrow to buy the raw materials and then you pay your workers to assemble the products and then you sell it to someone upstream, but then they might have a 60-day policy. They'll pay you within 60 days. So you need that cash to kind of carry you along between when you put it out for the raw materials and the payroll and when you get paid on your end. And right now, that money is just frozen up, both because banks are just and lenders are terrified to put any money out, and also because there's a bit of panic buying in the credit markets right now. We've seen some very large household name corporations that did have credit lines of $1 billion or $2 billion. They drew it all in. They called the bank and said, we'd like that $2 billion today. We don't need it, but we're going to put it under the mattress because we just don't know.
Well, has business always been this dependent on credit? And I mean, is there a flaw in the way we're doing business now if it is that dependent on credit?
Business has always been dependent on credit to some degree, again, because of that disconnect between when you need the money to buy the raw materials and pay your workers and when you get paid. But to the extent that so much more of the economy and particularly consumers are using debt to buy their products and services. And the consumer spending represents about 2/3 of the economy. Again, if we're borrowing more and more, it's just adding more debt into the system, which increases the desire for credit.
All right, let's take another call. We're going to go to Mike. And Mike is calling from Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to ask the gentleman, I own a small construction development company in Tallahassee, Florida. I've been in the business since 1986. And I would like to ask if the bailout was approved tomorrow, which I think, you know, there is a good 90% chance they will approve that. Once that is approved, how long does it take before the bank may not get back to 100% of the way they were doing business and providing us the credit and all that, but how long will it take before things get back to semi-normal? And also, I would like to make a comment that since our president made the comment to the world that either you are with us or you are against us, world taught us a lesson. And this is the price we are paying right now. But I would like to ask that.
You want to know. I'm going to ask him to respond to that first question because I think it's a good one. How long are business people like Mike in Tallahassee? How long are they going to have to wait to really see a change? And thanks so much for your call, Mike. Dean?
It's a very good question. I can't give you exact date and hour, but it's going to take a while. It will come back in degrees, but it won't happen soon. I don't think we'll ever go back if he was describing the past 7 years or 8 years as normal. I don't think it will go back to that. I'm not sure we necessarily want it to now that we know how much economic activity was driven off sloppy mortgage lending and such. But it's going to take a time. I mean, right now the unemployment rate's around 6%. Unemployment claims the report came out. It rose, which is why the market was down today. Economists I trust are talking about an unemployment rate that could go up to 7%, 8%. I think we're going to be in for a recession. I think it could be a hard recession, and it could last a good year and a half to 2 years. So it's not going to – we're going to have to – it's going to take a while to heal the economy and heal the financial system.
All right. We're going to bring in another guest now. Joining us by phone from Santa Monica, California, is Jesse Toprock. He's the executive director of industry analysis for the automotive website Edmunds.com. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So how bad are things now for car dealers?
Pretty bad, actually. We just got the September industry results for sales, and it was for the first time under 1 million units. And the last time, to give an example of how bad things were, last time we had under 1 million units in the industry was February of 1993.
Yeah. Well, is this all because of credit being tighter, or are there other factors as well?
Well, we gather that the number one reason why the sales are low for the new vehicle sales and the industry is that consumer confidence is simply at the very bottom right now. A lot of consumers who have the ability and the desire to purchase are postponing their purchase decisions until the dust settles in the economy. The second main reason why the sales are low is, as you mentioned, is a credit crunch and the lenders becoming extremely selective. In fact, sometimes paranoid as to who they should lend to. So the access to credit is limited. Even those consumers who could get a loan last year can't get a loan this year. So the consumer confidence, along with very tough access to credit, is really having an impact on new vehicle sales.
Now, are you hearing stories from car dealers that illustrate what you just said, that you know they thought they had a deal and then it fell through because somebody who seemed to have a pretty good credit rating just couldn't get the loan?
Happens every day. Well, number one problem right now for car dealerships is the showroom traffic. They simply can't get anyone to even take a look at the cars. And once you get someone finally to their showrooms that are who's willing to look at a car and maybe purchase one, they apply for a loan. And unless they have perfect credit, which is maybe one quarter of the nation has perfect credit, the rest has to struggle to get a loan, they apply for a loan and they realize that either they cannot get approved under any condition or they're facing extremely high interest rates and or very high cash down payments, which usually they don't have.
So if cars aren't being sold, what does that mean for car makers and those who they employ?
It's tough times, and we're seeing that, interestingly, no one is immune to the weaknesses in the marketplace. We've seen automakers like Toyota posting about a 35% decline in September, the worst they had in 40 years in the U.S. market. So it's spread all over the place. And if you look at the scope of the automotive industry, it's huge. there are literally millions of people indirectly or directly impacted by what's going on, manufacturers, suppliers, people working at dealerships, service, gas stations, everybody really is being impacted by this. So the implication is huge, and we're hearing a lot of stories from dealerships that, especially the ones that are not doing well, some domestic brands, are really struggling to just pay the bills and be in the business, and there are some of them that will be unfortunately eliminated due to simply the fact that they can't sell any cars.
All right. Well, Jesse, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Jesse Toprak is the Executive Director of Industry Analysis for Edmunds.com, and he joined us by phone from Santa Monica, California. We're also talking with Dean Faust. He is the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Businessweek Magazine. We're discussing the credit crunch and what the credit crunch means on Main Street. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're going to take a call now. We're going to go to Peggy. And Peggy is calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My name's Peggy Wardlaw. I'm an engineer by training and a small business owner. And we actually bought in to the started buying real estate, even though we were petroleum engineers, my husband and I, back in the early 90s here in Texas, and really made a fortune, to be honest, by buying really cheap real estate when there were all the foreclosures in the Texas and the savings and loan crisis. And I'm also a registered appraiser, so we appraise real estate now. And what I know is that the government, when they step in the way they're trying to step in now, and, you know, and allow everything to go ahead and go into foreclosure, that the market craters, which makes it even worse. And we're trying to sell an office building right now. We have a lot of people who want to buy it, and it is really hard to get financing, and that's true. But I don't like the bailout idea because it allows a plan that was put together by the people at the top of our financial service industry that got us into this mess in the first place to develop the plan that bails them all out but doesn't really insert money into the system at the bottom to really allow the credit markets to open back up. And it just seems to me like, and I ran some numbers, that they could, for $39 billion, pay every single residential foreclosure payment that's in arrears right now.
All right, well, let's see what our guest, Dean Faust, has to say about that. Thanks for your call, Peggy. Okay. Peggy's offering some interesting alternatives there, Dean.
It sounds very good to this idea of don't bail out the greedy Wall Street bankers, help the poor people that are struggling to pay their mortgages, and you sound inhumane to argue against that. But I'm not sure it's the best solution. I think there are things you can do in small ways to help struggling borrowers. But on the other hand, who's to say that you don't give all that money to the struggling homeowners, and they spend it on everything but their mortgage payment. They buy a new boat and they go on vacation in Hawaii. And in some other instances, as we know now, there are a lot of people that took out mortgages on homes they couldn't afford then. And helping them catch up on 3 months of mortgage payments or 6 months, that doesn't help them make next month's payment either. So I do think the solution is some variation or form of what the Congress is looking at now, which is pumping money back into the Wall Street, the financial system, so that they can have the money to make new loans and do it in a way so that Uncle Sam gets some kind of upside. Everybody talks about the $700 billion, and I've seen some estimates by really good economists saying that, okay, maybe the Uncle Sam loses $100 million on all this, all said and done, but Uncle Sam could turn a $200 billion profit on all this at the same time if it all comes together right.
Let me just read you one email to end the show. This is from Joe, and he says, "The current economic situation has not had a negative effect on me at all. In fact, I got a letter from my credit card company yesterday increasing my limit by $3,000, and the value of my home has risen by $50,000 in the past 3 years. Maybe I'm just lucky." So is Joe just lucky, or are there a lot of people like Joe who will escape this all unscathed?
There are people who will escape this unscathed. And even though we may not want to hear this right now, there are going to be people who make extraordinary fortunes and profit from the current situation we're in. You know, an old saying on Wall Street is there's no such thing as a bad bond, they're just bad prices, that everything has value at the right price. And there will be people who buy these mortgage bonds for 15 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar. And eventually, the economy, I think, will stabilize. It may be a slow recovery, but it will recover, and sometime down the road, all these people that bought at the bottom will have made big fortunes.
Dean Foust, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dean Foust is the Atlanta Bureau Chief of Business Week magazine. Here in Washington, the Shakespeare Theater Company is staging an all-male production of Romeo and Juliet. In a minute, the director, along with the actor who plays Juliet, will join us to talk about the new discoveries that emerge about this timeless classic when it's performed as it was originally intended. If you'd like to talk with them about the play, or if you've ever seen an all-male production of Romeo and Juliet, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, and the email address is talk@npr.org. David Muse is the Associate Artistic Director for the Shakespeare Theater Company and the director of this season's production of Romeo and Juliet. James Davis is the actor who plays Juliet in this all-male cast. They join us now here in Studio 3A. It's so great to have you with us.
Thanks, Lynn. Great to be here.
Yeah, likewise.
Great. And David, tell me, what led to your decision to direct Romeo and Juliet with an all-male cast?
Well, it was a few things. Michael asked me to direct Romeo and Juliet.
Michael
Kahn, the artistic director, asked me to direct Romeo and Juliet. And I had to hunt around for a way to make the play feel fresh and interesting for me, and I also hope for our audiences. It's because it is the best known play by Shakespeare. It's the one we first read. It's the one we've seen the most number of times. And I was hunting around for a way to make it interesting again for us, to provide a new lens in a way that didn't feel put on or, you know, like I was setting the play in a period that felt like might work but wasn't ultimately getting at what was at the heart of the play. And so I thought, what better way than to try to do this all-male convention, which I'd seen done a number of times very successfully over the last 10 years. A lot of the most influential productions I'd seen had done it. But I'd never seen anyone try to do it with a love story.
Yeah.
You know, people try to do the convention with gender-bending comedies very frequently, comedies more often. So it felt risky. I hoped it would provide some new perspectives on the play. A play that we know so well.
James, did you have any trepidation about taking on the part of Juliet?
No, I'm open to like any opportunity to play any sort of role. I embrace the challenge of doing something like this. I've had the experience of playing a few female characters before in Shakespeare, but never to the degree of full costume, full wig, full shoes, flats, women's flats. It's always been more of a low budget kind of take like a cotton stretchy fabric and wrap it around the body.
Right.
With some off Broadway theaters.
You were saying that you had 26 members of your family came to see the show on Sunday.
Yeah.
And what was their reaction?
It was great. I was saying right before we walked in here, I feel like Romeo and Juliet and Shakespeare and this production, I feel like there are themes that everybody can relate to. You know, a lot of the student audiences relate to the love story, maybe finding their first love, and maybe they're not aware that we are presenting the same things in the story that they're going through. But I have a little niece, and she's at 9 or 10, and she was reacting to the part where Capulet is yelling at her daughter, at his daughter, on the floor, and she's crying and on the floor weeping and wailing. And so even someone who's 9 or 10 years old who hasn't felt love before, there's this theme of a parent-daughter relationship that she can really relate to. And I thought that was really sweet and really telling. And there's many facets of the story that can come across.
One thing I was struck by, David, is there was a lot of humor in this production of Romeo and Juliet. And there isn't always. Sometimes they're done very stodgily so that you don't see all the humor. But I wondered if you went for the humor more especially, if having an all-male cast lent itself to that or what?
A number of people have noted that, and it's been so interesting to me because I didn't set out at all to make the play, to mine it for its humor. We just really took it seriously moment by moment and saw that what was there. I think the play is very funny, purposefully so. I think it waits as long as it can to be a tragedy. And scene after scene, you think there's going to be a way that it could all work out okay. So we did work hard not to sort of, you know, make it feel like a tragedy throughout. We thought that that would actually make the tragedy play more powerfully. I'm sure part of having a company of men in the room brought some humor out, just because there was a playfulness there that can happen when you get a whole group of men in a room making a play together. But it wasn't an agenda we had at all.
Well, I was wondering if there were any discoveries that you did make by casting the play this way that you might not have directing it in a more traditional way in the text. I mean, anything that you that came out of it.
Yeah, a lot of things. I think Jimmy and I could probably go on and on. I do have to say, you know, first of all, that one of the surprising things is how little ultimately it winds up mattering. There is an experience you have after about 10 minutes when you can forget about the convention and you realize that artifice and pretense are just such a part of any theater watching experience, and you sort of get over it. But it does do some interesting things too, both to create the world in which the play happens, which is a very masculine dominated one, and Shakespeare goes to great lengths to make that a big part of what he's writing about in the play. Of course, there's lines all over the place about behaving like a man or behaving like a woman. And so you start to pay, I think, paradoxically, even more attention to the performance of gender in a world like that when you have an all-male cast. And then, and Jimmy can maybe talk about this more at length, but we also discovered some interesting ways in which the relationship between the two central lovers works when you're doing an all-male cast.
And I was going to ask about that,
Yeah, specifically, it turns, I think, from a relationship that's concentrated on sort of a romantic sexual love that we've seen so much to one that has to do with the interplay of wit and of language between two lovers. There's a friendship level and an admiration of the exchange of wit level between these two lovers that I think in mixed cast productions we often miss.
Yeah, James, what was your take on those on the love scenes?
Yeah, there was a line that popped out to me very early on, and it was, "Art thou gone so, love, Lord, I, husband, friend?" And Finn and I really connected to that idea of friendship. We thought it would be a great thing to discover in this all-male production. And the passion is in the language. I keep reading that when it was done, you know, in the 16th century, that the audiences would have loved to see like a severed head come on stage and violence and this humor, and not so much two men on stage in a bed, you know, being very passionate with each other. And Romeo and Juliet have very few scenes together. In the second act, they have one scene where they're both conscious at the same time. It's in the beginning, and they're saying goodbye. And Romeo has been exiled, and it's very quick. It's under extreme circumstances. It's like, go, you have to go, you have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Well, let's see. We have a caller here now. Let's go to Ellen. She's in Indianapolis. Hi, Ellen. Ellen, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I'm an opera singer, and I find that in opera, we often have love scenes between two women because oftentimes part of a young man is played by a woman. I've been in a couple of love scenes. One was from an early Mozart opera. I can't think of the name at the moment. Another one is Der Rosenkavalier by Strauss, which has a very passionate love affair between a young man and a woman, and the young man is played by a woman.
And how does that work out? I mean, is that awkward at all, or...?
It's maybe a little bit awkward, but really it's no different than acting. Usually if you're playing opposite a man, it's not necessarily, you know, your husband or your boyfriend. So I didn't really find it as awkward. Once somebody's in the costume, they got their pants and their jacket on, and for all intents and purposes, they're a young man.
I would also imagine that in an opera, when you're singing so continuously, just like in Shakespeare, where you're speaking so continuously, the passion comes in the language. It's in the language and not so much of these silent moments where there's hot and heavy petting on stage, you know. We can focus on the art in that way, both opera and Shakespeare.
Right.
All right. Thanks for your call, Ellen.
Okay, thank you.
And here's an interesting email from Paul. He says, I saw a troupe from England that did all-male Shakespeare. It was interesting to see how men think women act. And I wonder, did you get advice from women at all about how women act or...
No, I have a few close friends, and I took a few of their habits. But other than that, I really just tried to focus on the language of the play and tried to come up with a Juliet that was both Finn's Juliet, who plays Romeo, David, the director, and my Juliet, something that was very organic. So I never really started playing a woman. I played the language first.
But you know what I thought was interesting, and I don't know if this came from you or from the director, but you got the sense of Juliet as a very young, not even a young woman, really as a girl. She was kind of a, you know.
I think that's right. And I actually think, and we haven't talked about this, Jimmy and I, because I don't want to make him self-conscious about it. but I actually think that as a young male actor, in an odd way, you can get away with playing a 14-year-old girl in a way that you couldn't if you were a female actor of Jimmy's age. I think if you were a woman trying to do that, it would feel like you were playing a little girl. It would feel like something put on. But somehow the artifice of an all-male production, and where it's so obvious that he's not the character, it allows him to play like you saw.
Right.
In a way that a woman might not be
kind of embarrassed, you know, she was very self-conscious about what was going on about herself, and she was actually tripping all over herself here and there too. I was wondering about
she talks herself out of, she's also very world wise, and she talks herself out of love so many times. But I think that the youthfulness came from this idea of everything's a discovery. Love's a discovery, punishment's a discovery, all these firsts that she had. And I feel like connecting to those, we came up with very youthful, unexperienced characters.
You've talked about your Romeo a few times, Finn. So how did he approach this? I mean, how did you approach the two of them together, working as two men together, being these lovers, these star-crossed lovers?
Well, the great thing is that Jimmy and Finn knew each other and had a strong friendship before they began this project. It was actually a funny story. They were both at Juilliard together, and first-year students are partnered with second-year students as buddies. They sort of have a buddy system at Juilliard. And Finn, or Jimmy, was Finn's buddy when Finn showed up at school. So they knew each other well. So a lot of what you might expect to be an uncomfortable situation between two people just was never operating. So we didn't really have to talk about it. We just played the scenes. They were comfortable with one another. We tried to figure out the balance between language and physical contact in a way that felt right to all of us.
David Muse is the director of the all-male cast of Romeo and Juliet, which is currently being shown at the Shakespeare Theater here in Washington. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I wondered if you've gotten any criticism at all for casting an all-male cast just because you know, so many women are out there looking for works, and it's such full of great women's roles. I would think that some actresses are not so happy with you.
I'm sure you're right. and like a lot of plays by Shakespeare, it's actually not full of great women's roles. There are four of them.
Right.
But Juliet but they're
is,
great.
But Juliet is one
they're
of them.
They're great. And sure. Sure you get that. And for me, it was for that reason, it was a difficult decision to make because I work in a theater where we do classical theater all the time. And there's some sex discrimination built into the very fabric of casting those plays because they almost always have many more men than women roles. So for actresses who are really talented classical theater actresses, there aren't that many opportunities, aren't that many roles. And to introduce into that reality a convention that makes it even harder for them to get a role at the Shakespeare Theater, I had to be really convinced that this was going to be a revealing way to do the play and that it was worth it in a way. And I hope that the people who might take issue with the casting choice, you know, will come see it and feel like
it was worth it.
It was worth it, yeah. That we learned enough by doing it.
All right, let's see if we can get a call here from Chris is calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Good, thanks for taking my call. I've got a quick comment and then a question. I'll take my answer via the radio. But when I was in secondary school in England, we took a road trip to in London, and we visited the Globe Theatre, and we actually watched an all-male production of a little snippet, and I believe you call it a review, of many different Shakespearean works. And a lot of us were immature at the time, but they really pulled it off. By the end, we were like, you know, hey, that's a man, but, you know, it's a woman. And, you know, it was great. And we all just forgot that it was being played by all men. And my question was, the maturity level of the audience, does that play a part in anything that you do in actually making your characters believable?
It's really amazing how an older audience, and we also do performances for student audiences too, how they both give over to the conceit of the all-male so soon. There's a kiss in the ballroom scene after the sonnet, and when we did it for the student audiences at first, some of the responses were, no. they did not like it at all, but in that goodbye scene in the second act, Romeo says, "One kiss and I'll descend," and we ran towards each other and kiss each other on the lips, and the students were cheering us on. They were really excited, which tells me they forgot. They gave in to the conceit, which was the point and was so amazing.
What kind of reaction? Thanks so much. Anything else you wanted to add there, Chris? I think he's gone. Thanks so much for calling, Chris. What kind of reaction are you getting in general, David, to the production?
Well, generally enthusiastic, but mixed. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want, I think, when you set out to do a production like mm-hmm. this. You know it's going to stir up different kind of responses in different people. And so it's been fascinating to watch how different people respond to it. In general, people take very little issue with the way we're doing it. Occasionally they do. It's been interesting that some of that response in a way feels from opposite sides, if you will, of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people, like you suggested, will respond from a gender discrimination standpoint. And some other people respond because they feel like there's some subtle social agenda that has to do with advancing the cause of homosexuals in the production. But those seem like pretty extreme. And in general, people get behind it enthusiastically, which I'm very grateful to see because I was very nervous about this. Mm-hmm. I felt like, is this the production that's pushing this convention to the breaking point? And actually, for a modern audience, will this be palatable? Or are we asking too much of our audiences? And I've been grateful to see that, by and large, we're not.
James, I have just one last question for you. Mm-hmm. Do you want to play Romeo?
I'd rather play Mercutio.
Well, if you get a chance to play Romeo, maybe this will give you some new insight into the character.
Yeah, I've played the other half.
Right.
I played the better half.
Thanks so much to both of you for being with us. James Davis plays the character of Juliet in the all-male cast at the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington. David Muse is the associate artistic director for the theater, and he directed this production, which runs through October 18th. They joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.